You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 9th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And a very happy Balloon Ascension Day to everyone.
Oh yay. Balloon Ascension presents for everyone.
You
all
made that up.
Love to get it up.
January 9th, 1793, the French aeronaut Blanchard made the first hot air balloon ascension in the history of America. And among the interested parties who helped construct the balloon was George Washington, first president of the United States.
That is fascinating.
You like balloons?
Today's a celebration of people who are full of hot air.
So people actually celebrate this by letting balloons just go up into the atmosphere, or they ride a hot air balloon?
Yes, they do. They ride in it, they release them, anything that floats up.
There are a multitude of ways you can celebrate Balloon Day.
That's
true. I saw one website, someone filled a bunch of condoms with helium or something.
And that's where Rebecca was going with that.
Well, it's not like they were going to use the condoms for anything else, were they?
The first news item, very big news item, very big. The first news item is the launch of SGU 5x5.
Yay.
New podcast.
Launch the balloons.
And the doves and everything. So as we said, so this is the task number two that we said we were going to do in 2008. We said we were going to start a new blog, and we did, Science-Based Medicine. We said we were going to start a new podcast, and we did, SGU 5x5.
Five minutes
with five skeptics. The first episode is on our website. Jay's been working around the clock adding all of the website stuff. It's on iTunes, although iTunes requires three episodes before they will make it go live. So it'll be a couple of weeks before it's actually
live on iTunes.
Well,
that's not 100% true. They prefer if you start with three episodes, but they will still submit it, but it might take longer or whatever. But you know how iTunes kind of operates in a bubble.
Yeah. It's not on there yet as of our recording of this, but the RSS is on the website. It'll be on iTunes just as soon as they get it up there. We've already registered with them, and we'll be registering it with Zune and every other aggregator out there. If you have one that it's not on, or if the Skeptics Guide is not on your favorite aggregator, send us an email and let us know. It'll be everywhere the Skeptics Guide is.
So the address is theskepticsguide.org/5x5, which is 5x5.
Right.
The feed is on there. Anyone who wants to submit our feed to any aggregators, please feel free to do it as long as you don't have to log in. The other thing is I'd like to thank everyone who responded to my request for help on the website. I'm sorry I haven't gotten back to anyone yet, and I will get back to everyone hopefully within the next week or two. I'm just amazingly busy with a lot of other things, and I'll try to
organize. Jay's too busy to actually coordinate the help with him because he's so busy.
Oh, the irony.
Yes.
But he will get back to you, and thanks for all the offers, and actually keep him coming because we have so much stuff to do. Another very quick announcement. I was interviewed recently for the Reason Driven podcast with Danny and Mikhail, and that episode is now up on their website, so we'll have the link. It's reasondriven.blogspot.com. It's like an hour-long episode, and it was a good chat, so give it a listen. The next news item is about biofuels. This is a topic that's been in the media quite a bit. This one has to do with a study looking at the use of a switchgrass in making biofuels. So the concept here is that by getting ethanol from plants that we grow, it's a carbon neutral endeavor, essentially, because the whatever carbon you put back into the atmosphere by burning it was put into those plants when they grew in the first place, unlike fossil fuels, which are releasing carbon that has been sequestered for millions of years into the atmosphere. So there's been a lot of attention paid to corn-based ethanol, and that's currently most biofuel in the United States, at least, comes from corn. But that has always been of dubious value. At best, there's a minimal advantage. In other words, you get a little bit more energy out of corn in the form of ethanol than what goes into growing it in the first place. There is, in fact, fossil fuel-based fertilizer. So you're actually like putting fossil fuels on the ground to grow the corn in the first place. And then, of course, the energy it takes to to grow and harvest and refine and everything the corn. So some people actually think it's either energy neutral, maybe even a slight loss. But you know, the most optimistic studies show that maybe it's you get 25% more energy out of corn based ethanol than what goes into it. Well, a lot of attention has shifted to switchgrass because switchgrass is easier to grow. It's a perennial plant, so you don't have to plant it every year. And it has, I guess, a denser cellulose.
So you're saying that they should switch to switchgrass?
Yes. The consensus is that we would be better off switching to switchgrass. There was a recent study, it was basically a plausibility study where they looked at growing switchgrass over 5 years and just calculated what went into growing it and how much switchgrass was produced. And the yields that were claimed from this study were about 540% of the energy that went into producing it could theoretically be gotten out of it in the form of ethanol. So this is a little theoretical because we don't yet have the manufacturing process, the biorefineries that actually could take the switchgrass and break it down into ethanol. So those would have to be built and the process would actually have to be finalized. But so that figure is somewhat speculative. But what they're saying is, at least on the theoretical grounds, we could be getting, you know, five times as much energy out of the switchgrass as goes into growing it. And that makes the whole biofuel endeavor at least plausible, whereas basing it on corn really wasn't much help at all.
And they're still improving. The agricultural scientists are still really making significant improvements on the yield. So even over the next 5 or 10 years, you never know where they can get to.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, but I think that the 540% is probably pretty close to what the maximal yield would be. I mean, that's how much energy is in there, you know, in the cellulose. Obviously, you know, efficiency can only take you so far. It can't actually put more energy in the switchgrass than could potentially be there. Some countries like Brazil use sugarcane for their biofuel. And sugarcane also is very, very energy dense and I think also easier to refine into ethanol. So that has been very useful for them. So this – and people have been talking about switchgrass for the last couple of years. I've been hearing about that. Like that's really the way to grow. So this – but this is the first evidence that shows, yep, the numbers add up. It's much better than corn. This is where we should be going. The next news item – has to do with the extinction of the dinosaurs. There's a new paper published that speculates that perhaps insects had a hand to play in the extinction of dinosaurs.
Yeah, this is a new wrinkle that I hadn't considered, although I find it satisfying in a way because I've always had a problem with the extinction of the dinosaurs through the conventional, either the asteroid or say it was the volcanoes, flood basalt volcanoes that were erupting and flooding the world with gases and lava, because it seems to me that if these catastrophic events were happening, the dinosaurs just really wouldn't linger for hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of years in the fossil record. I think it would be more abrupt if it was such a catastrophic thing.
Yeah, but Bob, before you go beyond that point, that's not established that dinosaurs lingered past the impact point in the fossil record. In fact, that is a point of contention.
And if I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, the majority opinion is that the extinction occurs right at the impact boundary.
Okay.
The evidence that was used to say that they lingered past that is actually not very good evidence, and there's only a minority of paleontologists who are pushing that point of view. So, although I think that the minority opinion has gotten disproportionate press. So it makes it seem like there's a real controversy going on,
okay,
that this, like, you know, whenever they promote evidence towards that end, it's said, oh, maybe the dinosaurs weren't killed by the meteor. But the fact is, if you talk to paleontologists, and we've interviewed Professor McLeod, for example, on our show upon this issue, the evidence really is overwhelming that there's a very, very clean bound asteroid boundary, and the extinction occurs right at that boundary.
Steve, so this might be a naive question, but don't modern lizards come from dinosaurs?
No. The only surviving animals that are descendants of dinosaurs are birds.
Birds.
That's right. Lizards are reptiles, but they evolved alongside dinosaurs and just survived past them.
Birds and, don't forget, sleestaks.
And sleestaks, that's right.
Oh, yeah, I forgot them.
But, Bob, to tell us about this new theory
Yeah, their take on this, and this is a book written by George and Roberta Poynar, I think is how you pronounce it. It's called What Bugged the Dinosaurs? Insects, Disease, and Death in the Cretaceous. And their idea is that these newly evolving biting and disease-carrying insects could have had a major hand in the extinction of dinosaurs. From their point of view, it's what could have caused them, and from what Steve said, I now know this is more of a minority view, what could have caused them to linger and take quite a while to finally die out. But they don't deny catastrophic events like the asteroid impact or the lava flows, but they say this is what really, you know, sounded the death knell for them. And they're basing it on things like insects found in amber that were alive during that time. They found pathogens, one that causes, let's see, Leishmania is a serious disease today that affects both humans and reptiles. They've also found in dinosaur feces nematodes and trematodes, never heard of those, and even protozoa that cause dysentery and other abdominal disturbances. So they think that this, you know, these things might have had a much, you know, an impact that I think haven't been anticipated until their groundbreaking release of their book.
So are they saying the dinosaurs were somehow in some sort of disease-ridden decline before the impact, or they were on their way out when the impact happened?
Well, yeah, the timing. I don't think you can really time it that closely. But the what really drove them to their final extinction is what they're saying is that it was these newly evolving disease-carrying insects that caused disease that just, you know, slowly just killed them all.
I mean, it's a very interesting idea that when insects really took off, that they would have presented a very significant challenge to animal life, you know, because now suddenly they're a new disease vector, a new vector for all kinds of infections, and immune systems were not as tweaked by evolution at that time as they are now. So, you know, and it is conventional wisdom that plagues, you know, can wipe out a species if it's bad enough, or if the species is vulnerable enough or small enough in population.
Steve, is it true that insects were like gargantuan back then?
They were bigger. They were bigger than they are now, and that is due to
greater oxygen,
increased oxygen concentration in the atmosphere at that time.
Like how much bigger? Like was there? You know, you always see like the dragonfly, like that's got a wingspan of a, you know, of an albatross.
Yeah, not that big. Not
an albatross. Yeah, not that big.
But maybe like a foot across, you know, as opposed to...
Remember Caveman Jay?
Yeah, when he smushed the bug on his face.
Right, there you go.
Right. So this is an interesting idea, and perhaps insects were putting a lot of survival pressure on animals at that time, including the dinosaurs. I'm not convinced that this played a role in the extinction. I, from my discussions on this issue, the impact was the final event, and that's pretty clear, so... I think they're basing this partly on the minority opinion of how to interpret that, the fossil evidence. Well, let's go on to your emails and questions. The first email comes from Amy Hurley from the United States, and Amy writes, "Neti pots are all the rage since Oprah and Dr. Oz gave them an on-air endorsement several months ago. These little gravy boat-shaped pots are used to swish warm salt water through the sinus cavities to keep colds and sinus infections at bay. Is this effective? Do neti pots also help shorten recovery time when a person does have a cold or sinus infection? Is it a good thing to pour warm, salty water in your sinus cavities? I haven't been able to find any information stating that it's a bad idea to do so, but I haven't found much real scientific data that says it really works." Then she concludes, "Up your nose with a rubber hose."
My entire office won't shut up about neti pots. And right. It's not just a little pot. Like, I guess you can use a little pot, but
it's like a chia pet for your nose, right?
Not even. That would actually be entertaining. This is just scary. One of my coworkers pulled out a plastic bottle that she proceeded to shove up her nose and demonstrate that you like squeeze this huge amount of water up into your nostril and it comes firing out the other nostril. Mm-hmm. And according to her and her doctor, the warm water travels up into her head somewhere and flushes everything out.
That would be up into the maxillary sinuses.
Thank you. Yes, the maxillary sinuses.
So
what's the deal, Steve? I salt water and snot, I assume.
Right. That's what comes out. Nasal content.
Salty snot water.
Well, it, you know, here's the thing. This is not a, a completely insane idea, and it may actually have some utility, but you have to separate out the various claims that are made for it. One very important separation to make is the use of this to treat a chronic sinus infection versus using this for everyday in an everyday way for healthy people to prevent infections. If you have, you know, a functioning, well-draining nasal cavity and are not especially predisposed to getting sinus infections, I don't think there's any evidence to support the chronic or preventive use for this. If, however, you have a chronic sinus infection, the most important thing to do for an infection, whether acute or chronic, is drainage, even more than antibiotics or anything else. I mean, you do sometimes do need these other things as well. You do need antibiotics, et cetera, if you have a bacterial infection. But drainage is by far and away the most important thing. And there is actually a literature on using saline lavage or saline drainage to try to basically wipe out all the crud from your sinuses and your nose, and that does speed recovery. So that's not actually an unusual idea, and the evidence, there is actually published evidence about it. I did find one review article on PubMed reviewing existing evidence, and this is from a few years ago. And so, again, not hugely studied. I don't think there's any definitive evidence out there, but what evidence is what evidence there is generally positive in terms of recovery when you have an infection. So that's one aspect of it. The other thing is there are a couple of effects here. One is that it washes out any backing up or buildup of nasal contents. Another is that it may remove pollen buildup. So if you have allergies, theoretically you could, you know, keep your sinuses clear of pollen, and that may reduce your allergic reactions. I didn't find any evidence specifically to support that claim. That's just a possible mechanism. And the third thing that's claimed for it is that it moisturizes the nasal mucosa, your membranes. And that's not unreasonable either, although you may accomplish that a little bit easier with just a little saline nasal spray. You know, may accomplish the same thing without having to actually stick a pot up your nose. If you have chronically dry mucosa, then using saline, which is salt water, to moisturize your nasal mucosa, it could be a good thing for you. I don't think there is evidence or justification for everyone doing this on a regular basis, like brushing your teeth just for hygiene or just for maintenance. I don't think there's any real reason or evidence for that. In fact, the concern that is raised is by doing that, you actually may deprive your immune system of stimulation from, you know, some viruses and bacteria that may be lingering in your sinus cavities. If it's not causing an infection, you know, being exposed to small amounts of viruses and bacteria actually is a good thing for your immune system because it stimulates an immune response. And being overly obsessed with hygiene and with sterility actually makes us more vulnerable. It weakens our immune system. So it's not always a good thing. Also, our mucosa are carpeted with friendly bacteria. Wiping them out with hot saline lavage may actually make you more vulnerable to unfriendly bacteria, theoretically. Again, I didn't see any evidence to say that actually is what happens. But theoretically, if you did this in an overly aggressive fashion, that could be a negative consequence. So it's not without its potential risks. It's also not without its potential benefits. There's not much evidence, but what is out there suggests it may be useful for actual chronic infections, but not for everyday use in a healthy person.
Good, because it looks weird.
So you can go back to your office, Rebecca, and tell him that. Or just have him listen to the podcast.
Yeah, right.
I will. The emailer mentioned Dr. Oz, by the way. And Dr. Oz is one of my least favorite members of my profession. He's really pushing a lot of alternative medicine woo nonsense. I wrote a very unfriendly review of him in my neurological blog a few months ago. I'll include the link to that as well.
So it's no great surprise that he's teamed up with Oprah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 That's Dr. Oz and Oprah have an alliance very similar to, say, Sylvia Brown and Montel Williams, you know.
Yeah.
One more email before we go on to our interviews. We have an interview coming up in just a moment with John Rennie from Scientific American. And we're also going to interview James Ranty about a news item that he announced on the JRF site recently. But first, one more email. This one comes from Rob McGeehee, and he writes, I ran across this article from a website I read daily. Thought you might be able to discuss the quality of this research and whether the findings are legitimate. I listen to your podcast every week and really appreciate all your efforts to produce such a fun and interesting show. Your 2008 predictions sound really plausible, and I look forward to remembering each one that gets fulfilled and forgetting the ones that don't.
Uh-huh.
Very well, good.
Thanks, Rob. So the article is about the healing power of magnets. And we've gotten a lot of email about this one. This story is getting a lot of play, which is why I wanted to talk about it. And actually, I also blogged about it today on the science-based medicine blog and further developed some points actually on my neurological blog. So I actually wrote two blogs about it today. But this is a study looking at a static magnetic field and its effects on inflammation. The quick overview is that a static magnetic field is not capable of inducing any electrical current, as opposed to, say, a pulsating magnetic field. There are some actual physiological effects of a pulsating magnetic field, like increasing the rate of bone healing, that have been established. But you can't apply any of that to a static magnetic field. A static magnetic field is static, so it does not generate any electrical current or electrical activity in the body. There is really no known mechanism at this point in time by which it can exert its effects. All of the theoretical effects have been shown to either be implausible, to be specifically not to be true, or that the magnetic fields that are used in common devices are not strong enough to produce those effects. What this current study does is look at a model of inflammation in a rat paw. So they inject a chemical that causes inflammation. And then they used static magnetic field of varying strengths in order to see its effects on inflammation. The hypothesis was that the static magnetic field actually caused vasoconstriction, a decrease in blood flow, and that would decrease inflammation, which is interesting because a lot of the claims that are made for magnetic products like insoles or knee pads or whatever claim that it increases blood flow. Although the one complexity is that these study authors claim that their prior research shows that it does both increase and decrease blood flow, depending on the situation, which I find a little implausible. Anyway, they claim that it shows that the inflammation decreased with the static magnetic field. However, there's a couple of problems with the study. The first is that it did not show a consistent pattern. There was decrease in inflammation with two of the lower strengths of the magnet, but actually the highest strength field had no decrease in inflammation. The authors say that shows that there's a threshold of effect, an upper threshold of effect. But the standard interpretation of that is that represents a lack of a consistent dose response. Right? So, for example, if you were studying a drug, if the effect goes away as you increase the dose of the drug, that would argue against the effect actually being due to the drug. That usually doesn't happen. Now, magnetic fields are different from drugs, but the principle is basically the same. If a small magnetic field causes a little bit of an effect, then a bigger magnetic field should cause the same effect, but bigger. So that did not happen, and I think the saying that it was due to a threshold of effect is a completely post hoc rationalization. I mean, you can't just make that up post hoc. You can hypothesize that, but that calls into question the conclusions of the paper. The other big problem I had with it is that it's being promoted on a lot of sites to show that, see, magnets work, but there's a couple of differences between what they studied and what you'll find if you buy a magnet on the market. One is that they're looking at rat paws, which are very tiny. The biggest problem with the static magnetic fields is that they drop off very quickly with distance. Most products list the strength of the magnetic field at the core of the magnet, but even a centimeter away, that strength can drop off significantly to almost nothing. So if you have a magnet in a bandage, the magnetic field outside the bandage is negligible, and then the magnetic field strength below the skin is even more negligible. By the time you get down to the tissue that you're interested in, the magnetic field is probably weaker than the magnetic field of the Earth, you know, in which we're all bathed. So that's the biggest problem. Most of the stuff on the market that people, you know, all the anecdotes say that that they work, you're actually getting no magnetic field functionally, you know, in the tissue that you're targeting. This study used, they measured the magnetic field at the tissue level. So their magnetic field measurements, you know, if what they say is true, is accurate. But they don't apply to all the stuff that's on the market, which gives you the core magnetic strength. And also, you can create that magnetic field in a rat paw because it's a tiny little thing, but then you can't. It'd be very, very practically difficult to apply that to like a human knee, for example, which is much, much, much larger. So even if there is a physiological effect, which I don't think this study adequately demonstrates, you probably can't apply it to humans. So my problem with all of this is not that they did this study and not the methods that they used. I think actually it was quite a fine study the way they did it. It's just the way it gets interpreted by the media and the way it's being used in order to promote dubious health products when you really cannot use this to support probably any product that's actually on the market.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
The last paragraph of this article concerns me a little in that they're quoting the fella, Thomas Skalak. And I just want to read this quote, what he says. "We now hope to implement a series of steps, including private investment partners and eventually a major corporate partner, to realize these very widespread applications that will make a positive difference for human health."
That's right.
So that sounds like a sales pitch.
Yeah,
right, to me, more than any kind of scientific expression of what's going on here.
That wasn't from the published paper, by the way. That was from an interview with him that was on many sites like Science Daily. So that was an interview with the press. That wasn't his technical paper you were quoting from, just to be clear.
Right, but doesn't it sound like he's already,
absolutely.
You know...
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like a sales pitch. I agree. And this research is far too preliminary. It basically just generated a lot of questions that would need follow-up, that would need to be validated. You can't really reach any clinical conclusions based upon this. And we don't even know if you can apply the principles to a human being. So, yeah, it's absolutely premature. But again, that's the disconnect. It's sort of using ambiguous preclinical data in order to sell products with clinical claims. That's a huge problem. Well, let's go on to our interviews. Joining us now is John Rennie. John, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's a pleasure to be with you all again.
And of course, John Rennie is the editor-in-chief of Scientific American magazine. And he is here to talk to us about a lot of the changes that have been happening at the magazine. Scientific American, I think like no other journal of which I am personally aware, has really embraced the entire Web 2.0 concept. So, John, can you give us an idea of some of the changes you have in store on the Scientific American website?
Well, sure. Thanks. Glad to have a chance to do that. We just recently overhauled our SIAM.com website, and really we changed it in a lot of ways. One thing that we did was we've reorganized the content in a sense so that it's organized to respond to people's interests. We tried to organize things into various categories and topics so that it's very easy if you've got a particular interest in astronomy that you can find your way to other related material and to other related sorts of articles that may exist on our site elsewhere. Another thing that went along with that was we also have done a lot to beef up the community side of what our website has. The point here was we just really wanted to make it possible for everybody who's a reader of Scientific American to be part of kind of our larger community, and as such to be able to establish their own blogs or post comments really on everything that we put up on the website. So these are all kind of very useful, interesting comments for us overall.
So tell us about the community, because I thought that was very, very interesting. Tell a little bit more about that concept.
Well, sure. The thing is about being a print publication is that for the most part, you have kind of a, traditionally, had a sort of one-way one-way route of communication. That is, we would publish things and it would go out to our audience, and aside from a small amount of reader mail that might come in, there really wasn't much of a conversation that was going on. Of course, one of the great things about the web is that it really can facilitate having a much more interesting exchange altogether. So one part of that is that when people, they sign up with Scientific American, it becomes possible for them to really treat that as a kind of homepage for them to establish their own blogs or post their own files there on the site that they can share with other members of Scientific American's community. We also wanted to make it possible for everybody to be able to post comments on every article that we put up onto the site. So that's certainly all a great addition. And in fact, there's one article that we're delighted to see how the response on this has worked from our January issue. We just posted an article about a grand solar plan. So they it started off almost as a thought experiment of sorts of what if the United States really wanted to get serious about solar energy? How far could it push things in that direction over the space of the next few decades? To how much of our energy needs could we switch over to be served by solar energy? We published that in the January issue. We put that up online as well, and we are getting this enormously gratifying outpouring of comments from our audience on this, with people writing in with great questions and comments and suggestions. The authors of the article then also been involved in a lot of ongoing dialogue with the readers, and they're clarifying questions that they had, but they're also taking suggestions from the readers. So it's great to see how that's working. And something that we're generally trying to do with a lot of the content, I dare I say, I think it represents a sort of future direction for a lot of publishing, is this new approach being a publisher in the modern digital era, of taking advantage of the best of what you can do with digital online publication and also with print publication. Digital is great because it's interactive, it's 24/7, it's very, very current. And print, of course, still you have a form of polished presentation that it's very hard to match online. So we're doing something increasingly with a number of articles where we're debuting some of these articles in sort of their preliminary edited form online, giving our audience a chance to be able to send in more questions or their own comments, their own ideas. We can address those and incorporate those into the article that then is ultimately published in print. We're doing a lot of this now through our website under a category of what we call Edit This. And again, we're just starting to do more of this. We've done some past experiments over the past couple of years, and we've just been really pleased with how that's worked out.
Yeah, I see you're calling that Science 2.0, or is that the overall concept, that there's a communication between the author or authors and a large number of people online or in the readership, and then that crafts the final product?
Right. I mean, actually, in this case, it's a funny case of sort of the form and function working together on this, in that we actually, the category of this sort of thing we're calling Edit This, but the article that we're actually have up at the moment is one by the science writer Mitch Waldrop called Science 2.0, because he's writing about the phenomenon of how increasingly scientists themselves are using wikis and blogs and other sorts of traditionally new online forms of communication to perform scientific research in an entirely new way, in a sort of much more open way. And it's something that it's a way of doing science that some people are very excited about and enthusiastic about. And as you could well understand, a lot of scientists are still sort of apprehensive. They don't know, they're not sure about what does it mean to be trying to do science sort of in such a publicly scrutinized way. Mm-hmm. There are lots of questions about who gets the credit for ideas, and if they They're posting some sorts of information online. Do they lose their ability to publish this later on? So it's another interesting sort of cultural change. We're sort of glad to be able to take a kind of science journalism 2.0 approach to writing about science 2.0.
Yeah, I mean, I very quickly noticed that when I started writing my first blog, that the feedback from the readers, the commenters, who were often expert scientists themselves, were very very savvy and knowledgeable, really helped me tweak and improve the article itself. You're sort of formalizing that process, and I think it's a great idea. It also, I think, serves the other purpose, which of course is, I think, the greater purpose for Scientific American and what we do, is just teaching the public about science. I mean, there's no better way to teach it than make them part of the process, right?
Right. I mean, really, you know, the heart of all of the scientific process is one of asking questions and then trying to systematically, logically explore how you could get to an answer about that. And I think it is wonderful for sort of being able to demythologize the process of science, and in a sense also demythologize a lot of what goes into, frankly, journalism as well, to see how, you know, anyone can have a question. Anyone's questions can be perfectly worthy, and so it's great to be able to have a chance to be able to put those up and you know, let the audience become a more active part of the process of how articles are put together.
You say that some scientists are kind of chafing at this new concept, and I could see how that would happen, but I do think that we're moving into an era where a scientist has to be a teacher and a journalist kind of all at the same time, really, to function in the new world that we're crafting, don't you think?
I think that's really true. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny. As I understand it, you know, Carl Sagan, who's a scientist who's probably strongly influential in uncounted millions of people having gotten interested in science, was in many ways sort of penalized by his peers because there were a great many of them who saw that there was something sort of vulgar about communicating science directly to the general lay audience. And yet, you know, during the, 18 or so years I've been here at Scientific American, I've noticed a shift among the scientists that we've worked with, and that I think maybe when I started there were still some traces of that as an attitude, but now more and more they know that it's entirely in their own best interests to be forthcoming with information, to try to get the public interested in their areas of research. So there've been a lot of changes that way, but you know, it's definitely the case that with a lot of parts of science 2.0, I think scientists' concerns aren't so much even about worried about how they're communicating with the public. They're really more worried about how will they be communicating with a lot of their own peers this way, and what kinds of communications would jeopardize the ways that they would eventually even be trying to publish scientific papers, be getting some share of credit for scientific discoveries. You know, it's an interestingly hazy area in a lot of ways. So it's not altogether unwise for a lot of scientists to want to try to feel this out very carefully.
Yeah, I understand that, but and a new ways of doing things will bring up new issues, but we'll have to work them out. You know, but I think that sometimes you just have to push ahead and force the issues a little bit. If you wait until we've, you know, dotted every I and crossed every T, then I don't think it'll ever happen. So
yeah,
sometimes you just got to dive in, right?
Yeah. So I think that's the case. And, you know, increasingly, of course, you have more and more scientists who've really been coming of age so much in the digital era that all these things will seem very, very natural to them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think if those who resist will just become part of the outgoing generation, and eventually, you're right, I think the upcoming generation will just be a foregone conclusion that everything's going to be done in a community digital fashion, because that's how they live their lives.
Yeah.
And while we're on the topic of the Scientific American digital and all of the online activities, I think since the last time we spoke with you, Scientific American at the time had one podcast, and now you guys have three podcasts, if I'm counting correctly. Is that right?
I think that's right. I periodically want to recheck to see if they've started coming up with another one that I don't know about, but that's right. We have our weekly science talk podcast that Steve Mirsky does for us, which is sort of a shorter magazine like format, sort of like what you do here with the Skeptics Guide. And then we also have a daily podcast under the 60 Second Science label, which is just as it says, a 1 minute presentation of science on any and all kinds of topics. And then more recently, we started to introduce a vodcast, a video podcast, that we try to present different short takes, again, short fun takes on science and explaining different sorts of ideas. A number of those we've labeled Instant Egghead, because the premise there is that it's a lot like you wandered into the office of one of the editors at Scientific American, and you've asked him or her to try to explain some heady scientific concept, and he or she then does the best that's possible using just the materials that are at hand there in the office. So, for example, George Musser, who's one of our astronomy editors, he did a wonderful job of explaining what dark matter was by just showing crumbs in a cup of coffee.
John, how long is this vodcast? Is it like 5 minutes or 3 minutes, or is there a typical length?
The vodcasts are sort of a little more flexible lengths. For the most part, they're probably on the order of about 3 minutes or so. But that's I think we're still feeling our way through in that area about what the public will tolerate, and of course, right, what we can actually manage to put together on the traditional shoestring available to us.
Yeah. Now, are there any plans for any more Scientific American Frontiers type documentary, or perhaps you're thinking of going more in a YouTube direction, start producing internet video?
Well, that's a very interesting idea. I know that at the moment, Scientific American Frontiers, which was a great show with Alan Alda, that's gone to that great big video archive in the sky. But I can't say Scientific American is certainly looking into what could be other kinds of TV opportunities that we can manage to put together for ourselves. We don't have a specific program ready at this point, but who knows, maybe it'll get something to change. And I think, the great thing about different types of online video are that, it is increasingly, it's a great, often bargain basement way for you to be able to start to get out there and communicate with your audience, right, in great interactive terms.
Yeah, I think that's one of the good things about the internet, is that it's so easy to innovate because the bar is very low. I mean, the investment is very, very low.
The other thing that's terrific about that is that the overall culture is one that's also sort of forgiving of experiments that don't work out very well.
Yeah, you just move on.
Yeah, I think really much more than, say, in print, if you come out with a new magazine and it doesn't seem like it's working out very well, it seems kind of shameful all around. A lot of people are embarrassed later, and can be a very costly mistake in most cases. But online you can try a lot of things, and you don't have to invest very much to start to see if it's going to work, and you can feel your way through, and you can say, oh, this isn't working out so well, and walk away from it if need be.
John, switching gears a little bit, in our your email before the show to me, you told me that you have recently visited the Creation Museum in Kentucky. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Yeah, this was a lot of fun. My wife and I had spent Christmas holidays out with her family, who live out in the corner of Indiana, right near the borders with Ohio and Kentucky. And it's basically only about an hour away from the big Creationism Museum that the Answers in Genesis people opened early in 2007. And my father-in-law, Larry, had been just been planning for a very long time that we would have to go there together. And so Larry and I went with my wife's grandfather, Warren. And I think it was an interesting threesome because, there's me from Scientific American. There's Larry, who I think has mentioned at various times that he may have a personal desire to bring the Catholic Church to its knees. and Warren, who is, I believe, a devout evangelical Christian, at least by general background, although he's not a creationist. And so it was interesting, the three of us, we went there, and it was interesting, although I think Warren actually put it best. I think all of us felt a little bit disappointed walking away from it. Warren had said, well, it's not exactly what I expected. And I know I sort of felt that way, because I think in a way, what I was hoping was that, you know, stepping into this creationism museum, that I would be seeing the strongly made case for their brand of young earth creationism. I would see them laying out all of their kind of scientific evidence and trying to convince me of the truth of this position. And yet, it really didn't seem like there was all that much science on display. And, you know, I say that, I'm like, well, of course there isn't. It's young earth creationism. It's about as unscientific a position as they could have. They don't have a whole lot they can point to. You know, it's a nice museum. They've got to, I would say it's sort of generally speaking state-of-the-art museum presentation over what they're doing. Much of the museum really is really largely just a presentation of scenes from and ideas of what happens in the Bible. And then it's just sort of sandwiched in amidst these other discussions of how evolution is oh so very wrong and how literally true Noah's Ark is and so forth.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I think if you have that particular faith going into it, I think you would find it, you know, it's a very, very nice museum, and I'm sure you'd find it very inspirational. I don't think there's a whole lot in that to convince anybody who hasn't basically already bought into that set of ideas.
Mm-hmm. So they're preaching to the choir.
Also literally in this case.
Yeah. And you thought it was more of like a theme park than a museum, really?
Very much, yes.
John, how was the gift shop?
Oh, the gift shop was a lot of fun. The gift shop, you know, they had lots and lots of books about the errors of evolution, how wrong Darwin is. You know, it was really everything that you could have wanted, for everything for kids and videotapes. It was very much like sort of the Bizarro World museum gift shop you run into.
Now, did you let them know who you were when you went through it, or would you go through stealth?
I sort of wondered. My wife has a high enough opinion of just what I must mean, the idea that she said, look, if you go in there, you tell them who you are, they'll surely know who you are. And, you know, I filled out a card as I was going in and listed my name on it, but no one immediately jumped on that. No siren sounded. I wasn't, you know, nobody tried to escort me off the premises or anything.
He is in the building.
I will also say that I was just vain enough that in the gift shop, I picked up a few of the books to see if my name or Scientific American was mentioned in some of them.
Mm-hmm.
For our own diatribes against creationism, and alas, I didn't actually see any. So, you know, it's good. It puts you in perspective.
It also brings up the topic of the intersection between science and politics. Recently, we had on our show Lawrence Krauss, who is one of the people who is behind the Science Debate 2008 movement, and you're also part of that group as well. Can you tell us about your involvement with that?
Sure, I'm actually one of the number of people who serves on the steering committee for this group. The point of this organization is that we are hoping we can convince the presidential candidates at some point to engage in a debate that would be entirely on matters of science and technology policy. And that's because from our view, science and technology are obviously highly important influences on a lot of crucial policies that will affect the present and future well-being of the United States. And we think that it would be enlightening for the public to see how it is that candidates understand scientific information, how they would use scientific advice, how that would affect the sorts of policy decisions and recommendations and leadership they would be offering were they to be president. I think some people have thought that, you know, we would be looking to try to turn this into some kind of science quiz for the candidates, which would not be the case.
Mm-hmm.
It is more interesting to try to get an idea about, you know, how might candidates respond to different sorts of advice they would be getting from groups from, say, the National Academy of Sciences and so forth. So the people behind this, it's very much a really nonpartisan desire to move forward with this. I think some people have feared that this is some sort of stealth attempt to try to bash some of the candidates who might be outspoken on religious. It definitely is not that. We just want to try to get the candidates to go on the record in this sort of live forum where they can talk about their views about these very important ideas, much as they would about healthcare or education or any number of other issues.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think science policy needs to be right up there with foreign policy and economic policy and domestic policy, or certainly social issues. I mean, these are all play prominent roles in presidential politics. I think science probably encompasses more different things of importance to people. Any early feedback? I mean, have you actually been trying to communicate with the RNC or the DNC? About this? Is there any early indication about how this is doing?
It is still very much in the early days about this. As you could imagine, it being a world of politics, there are sort of lots of channels and protocols you want to be very careful about, because obviously you don't want to give anybody the wrong impression. You don't want to be scaring away people. So you want to try to do this all very carefully. The great thing is, at this point, we're starting to establish the right sorts of contact through all the appropriately through the right sorts of channels, through the parties and through the candidates' own organizations. Right now, what's been very gratifying in this, how this has been going so far, is just seeing how many people have been signing up for the petition on the ScienceDebate2008.com website, including lots of really terrific scientists, but other well-placed figures in sciences, theologians. I believe there are 15 or 16 Nobel Prize winners on the list at this point. But if anyone who's curious should just go to ScienceDebate2008.com and you can see the full list. Or, and if you're so inclined, certainly sign up in the petition endorsing our call to try to get the candidates involved in this.
Now, this cycle you're aiming for a general election debate between the two nominees. Is that correct?
It's the timing on this is, I think, to a certain extent, we would be perfectly happy to have this happen still during the primary season. It's a very, very busy time for all of the candidates, and once things have started to narrow down that we've got the final candidates for each party, well, then it's very, very hard to try to get them to engage in a debate that might be seen as be having, too narrow a base of interest. We're trying to move things along. I think we would, we're still sorting out what might be the most appropriate timing on this. We certainly, naturally, from making this proposal, we want to be working with all the right people, in the political parties and in the candidates' campaigns, because we don't have an agenda we're trying to push on this.
Bob, you had a question?
Yeah, John, I'm interested in your perspective on what you think the most significant scientific discovery of 2007 was and what you think is most promising for 2008.
Oh, boy, that is always a tough one. There are lots of things that stand out on that. The journal Science pointed out that they felt that sort of the great breakthrough for this year was the richer study of human genetic variation. That's a broad, very worthy thing to have mentioned that way. The discoveries in the past few years, Human Genome Project and all the rest, that we have what are in many ways an astonishingly small number of genes, just 24,000 or 25,000 genes or so, which is not that many more than creatures like certain worms or insects do. And yet, there's a level of complexity that we milk out of this. That's partly because we're finding out that there's so much other control information that's embedded inside our genome, that we're finding out that there are roles that RNA, which traditionally we saw as kind of a handmaiden to the DNA in our cells, we're seeing that it involves a much more central regulatory process. The more we look at the genome, the more that we see that it's just fantastically rich in additional information that we need to study. I continue to be really fascinated by all the work that's being done under this area of artificial biology.
Yes, synthetic biology.
you know, I think in terms of sort of any emerging technology, I just find that to be absolutely fascinating. Artificial biology is this approach to traditional genetic engineering is entirely a kind of one-off process, that you are changing genes basically one at a time, and you are tweaking each manipulation that you're making to try to get the result that you want. With artificial biology, you're taking it to a whole new level, that you're putting in a whole network of well-studied interacting genes. So it's in effect, it's you're introducing programming into living cells, so that they will behave in very complex ways that you can completely control. And yeah. You know, theoretically, you might even be able to sort of create a living cell from scratch, one in which everything that's in it is something you put there.
They're predicting in 2008 they might have a major breakthrough in that regard. I think this has tremendous potential.
You know, I mean, the other biggest, very exciting body of biological work that took shape this past year was, a lot of work on stem cells in general continued to still be yes. really, really interesting. There was the work at the very end of the year, this amazing discovery of the work on being able to create these iPS cells, mm-hmm. these induced pluripotent stem cells
right.
that seem as though they might have, you know, all the kind of flexibility associated with embryonic stem cells. It's going to be a while before we ever know that that's really true and whether or not we can actually use them therapeutically, but they will be at the very least fantastic for being able to study the phenomenon of how stem cells work and how you can right. get them to do things.
Well, John, it's been a pleasure as always. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, I completely enjoyed it. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and all the rest of the Skeptics Guide team.
I hope we'll be seeing you at TAM 6, maybe?
That's certainly my intention. Last year I attended my first TAM meeting, and I had a blast, and I'm pending work managing to throw a wrench into the works. I'm very much looking forward to going back this year.
Great. Well, we hope to see you there.
Great.
Take care.
Night,
thanks, John.
Bye.
And now, Randy speaks.
Joining us now is James Randi. Randi, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Good to be here. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. I know. But you're here with us tonight to talk about some recent news with the Randi Million Dollar Psychic Challenge. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes. I'd planned this for the last 6 months or so, and I thought an anniversary was coming up, but it would soon be 10 years that we'd had the challenge so active and such, and frankly, it hadn't done what I had hoped that it might do, that it might attract some of the big fish, but of course, I really should have known that they wouldn't dare come anywhere near it, because they know very well they can't do what's required to do in order to win the prize. They just can't do it, and they know that, of course. They know what they can do and what they can't do. So that had been a bit of a disappointment for me, but more than that, most important thing is that it was taking far too much of our time and labor. It required our constant attention. We were constantly, it's not that you handle one person and that person goes away. You start to handle one person and that person sticks around for a year or so. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. It was a constant battle to try to get these people to understand simple things like sign your name. A few things like this. They didn't seem to understand anything. We got some applications that came in the mail. They were signed. They just signed a name at the end. They didn't say what they could do or how they could do it or when or where or anything like that. They just signed their name. And we had to send it back with a questionnaire saying, what do you think you can do? And will you get this form notarized according to the rules? Oh, well, I didn't think it was necessary to do this. They just didn't understand any of it. This takes time. It takes a lot of your patience, and it takes a lot of your strength to do this kind of thing. And we were spending far too much time on it. And frankly, I felt, well, it would be very nice if we were able to put this $1 million to work and we certainly could put that in reserve. It's always been making money for us with interest through Goldman Sachs and such, and I don't know what I'll do with it exactly, but if we have any big projects that we have to do, we can reach into it.
Mm-hmm.
There will be 2 years from March the 6th, which is the anniversary of when it started 10 years ago. There will be 2 years from that exact date, and I haven't noticed anybody clamoring at the door, you know, and then banging on the door, oh, I've got to hurry, you know. The test may take 2 years long to do. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't made any difference so far, except we got a lot of reaction. And the reaction is about 50-50. Yes, that's a good idea, and yes, no, that's not such a good idea. It's been approved and unapproved by a lot of people, so it's a mixed bag.
Randy, what do you think of the arguments against not doing it?
Against not discontinuing it, you mean?
Correct.
Well, I wouldn't mind too much. When I look at the two complete filing cabinets that we've got there, papers and such, I say, well, we certainly have room in the filing cabinets. We can just put another cabinet on the end of the thing, and we can continue for another 10 years or we would have to. But I'd have to have a compelling argument to continue it, frankly.
Randy, my question is, about a year ago, you changed the nature of the Million Dollar Psychic Challenge and made it more by invitation. In other words, not everyone who is self-deluded into thinking that they have magical powers can apply to it, because, as you said, that was taking up a lot of resources and wasn't really accomplishing much. Did that not accomplish the goal that you had intended of freeing yourself from a lot of the logistics and focusing on the big fish that you were wanting to go after?
Yeah, well, of course, I've never been really after the big fish. After the first couple of months, I realized my first error in the thing was that the big fish are not going to come anywhere near us, and they're going to ignore us as much as they can. When Sylvia Brown said she didn't know how to find me, I knew that there was something drastically wrong here. Here's a psychic, a world-renowned psychic, who can't use a phone book. She doesn't know how to reach me. And Uri Geller says he wouldn't do it because he doesn't like me, which seems to be all the more reason to want to do it. But I realized that they were just going to shut the door and just hope that it would go away. Well, of course, they'll be rejoicing in evil land now that it will be going away to a certain extent. But I'm still not going to let them off the hook. It's a mixed bag, Steve. It's really a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It's hard to decide whether it was the right move or not, but certainly the staff is a little more pleased, I think.
Yeah.
They see that they don't have to put so much sweat into this thing. But terminating it itself is going to be quite a job, of course. Trying to handle all the people who in the last 2 months will suddenly decide they're psychic.
That's right. Now, I can imagine it was a very difficult decision for all of you. And, you know, for me, the one thing, I think the one negative aspect of ending the challenge was, even if nobody ever took you up on it, that very fact was always a very useful thing to have, to say, well, you know, if your claim is true, why aren't you submitting yourself and taking $1 million from the skeptics? And it's sort of a rhetorical point. I'm not sure it's worth $1 million, you know, in order to be able to make that point. And I guess that's what you're saying. You want to put it to better use.
Well, it's I don't intend to use it. I don't intend to spend it at all, but it's a nice thing to have sitting there in case you do need to use it under emergency circumstances, in reserve, so to speak. Again, it's a mixed bag. It's very difficult for me to explain just what the nature of the thing was over the years. It got to be, what's the expression? Pain in the ass. That's what the expression is, yes. It was, again, using too much of our time and of our facilities, and it's going to be a relief not to have the thing around. But your basic point, I gather, is that it was a nice thing for skeptics out there to be able to say, well, if you're so psychic, why won't you take the $1 million prize? But they had answers for that. A, there's no $1 million prize, they would say. And then you'd have to go through the whole thing. Yes, I've seen the certificate from Goldman Sachs. The money is there. Well, he won't pay the prize. Well, how do you know that he won't pay the prize? And it goes on and on like this. You're arguing with idiots in many cases. They're smart idiots, though, in that they know how to make the argument so that people out there who choose to believe them will go along with it. And we've had this for for the last 3 or 4 years very, very strongly.
Now, you said you're not letting the likes of Sylvia Brown off the hook by this. Does that mean if she says 3 years from now, oh, I would take the challenge if it wasn't taken off the table, you'd make an exception for her? And
oh, I'd take it right back on again. Oh, yes, yeah. I'd lay it right in front of her. Say, you're on, Sylvia. And, of course, then she wouldn't do anything again anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly, when the thing terminates, I'm going to make the announcement that should somebody come along and really insist they have the powers and they can prove it, right? Bang, it's up on the table immediately again, and it will be always available.
So it will no longer be open, but it could still be used as needed.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So, Randy, do you have plans for all of the time that this is going to free up? Maybe some relaxing in the sun?
I remember the expression free time. I used to entertain the idea of having free time, but I just don't have any of that. I'm only working 7 days a week now. I've slowed down somewhat, you see.
You've cut back, yeah.
Yes. I'm not complaining. Not complaining at all. This is what I want to do. This is what I love to do. This is what I seem to have been born for. I guess God made me ready for this or something. I don't know. Whatever you want to use.
Hey, Randy, I have a question about the prize. I wrote a blog questioning who it was, in fact, was the wealthy sponsor who increased the challenge to the $1 million back in 1998. And some people were suspecting perhaps it was Johnny Carson. Have you ever made that public as to who it was? And
the person is still alive and well, I assure you. He just doesn't want to be known. That's all there is to it.
Has he given you any feedback about your decision to discontinue?
Yes, oh yes. No, I went all the way up north to meet with him, as a matter of fact, and sit with him, discuss the matter. And he was in approval of it. After all, he has given me the power to run the foundation as I see fit. That is, if the Board of Governors will let me do that. And so far, they haven't offered any bigger impediments.
Well, Randy, thank you for giving us the time to explain this move. I know everyone is very interested in hearing it straight from you.
Mm-hmm.
So always good to talk with you.
Well, it's a pleasure, and we'll have to do this more often.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Randy.
Take care.
Okay.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science and news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for our items this week?
Yes.
See. Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. I think this is going to be an interesting week. Here we go. Item number 1. Astronomers have found a 10,000 light-year diameter cloud of antimatter around the center of the Milky Way galaxy, apparently produced by binary systems that include a black hole.
Oh, yes, of course.
Item number 2. Recent measurements indicate that the Pacific plate may have temporarily stopped moving. And item number 3. Researchers find that having a higher serum cholesterol actually has health benefits. Jay, please go first.
Okay. What is serum cholesterol?
Blood cholesterol.
Yeah, serum is blood. Your blood cholesterol.
Oh. Since when?
So it just means high cholesterol.
Yeah, high cholesterol.
What are you
why don't you just say that?
Yeah.
I'm being precise.
What other kind of high cholesterol can there be?
Diet. Higher cholesterol diet.
All right. Well,
brain.
Other than that, why don't you just say... Yeah, forget it. Okay, we got
you're stalling.
It.
Now you're stalling.
And I got
come
it.
On.
All right. It's, you know, saying that having a higher serum cholesterol actually has health benefits?
Yeah.
Yeah, like there could be some minor health benefits, but it's still going to kill you. Right? Is that what you're saying?
I believe it's self-explanatory.
The astronomers have found a 10,000 light-year diameter cloud of antimatter around the center of the Milky Way. I don't know why that one sounds familiar for some reason. The measurements indicate that the Pacific plate may have temporarily stopped moving. I mean, these are good ones, Steve. Very difficult. It's obvious we're going to be like, well, the cholesterol's bad, so that's got to be that one, and that's the trick. The kung fu is good. Okay, I'm going to take. I'm going to say that the Pacific plate one is fake.
Okay, Evan?
I'm reading a book called The Smithsonian's Guide to the Universe, and it was written a couple years ago. And I happen to be passing through a chapter right now in which they talk about antimatter and Milky Way galaxy and so forth. So I'm inclined to say that number 1 is Science. It's just an extension of the reports from that book from a couple years ago. Recent measurements indicate that the Pacific Plate may have temporarily stopped moving. Temporarily stopped moving? How do they know it's temporary? Or that it stopped moving at all? I'm dubious about that one. And then researchers find having higher cholesterol actually has health benefits. Yeah, I'd say that's plausible. So I'll agree with Jay. Pacific Plate, fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Ah, crap. I thought that one was true. But I really don't know. But I'm going to go with the cholesterol one. I don't think higher cholesterol is good. Unless it's the good cholesterol, which I don't think that this is referring to. In other words, I have no idea. I'm going to go with the cholesterol one.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, that's a good point. We talking HDL or LDL? Probably overall cholesterol. All right, so number one, the 10,000 light-year diameter cloud of antimatter. I think you guys missed a point on that one. The news here is that what produced it, and it's saying that binary system that includes a black hole might have produced it. The 10,000 the antimatter by the center of the Milky Way. I've read about that years ago. So the new thing here is the binary system, which I don't think included a black hole. But so that's I think I'm going to say that's science. Pacific Plate temporarily stopped moving. That doesn't bode well. I don't like it when Pacific plates stop moving. What the hell?
That's a pet peeve of mine too.
How do you stop that? I mean, talk about momentum.
Yeah.
Crap. That's whew. All right. Three higher cholesterol has health benefits. I could kind of see how there might be some obscure little thing that it could help if you have this and this happens, it could actually be a little benefit from one perspective. I can imagine that happening, but I think Steve, you might have thought that two would plate would throw me for a loop. All right, I'm going to go with two. The plate stopping doesn't sound right.
Okay.
Oh,
fiction.
Man, so it's just
so you all agree that there is a 10,000 light-year diameter cloud of antimatter around the center of our galaxy caused by binary systems that include a black hole. And that one is science. So you're all safe on that one.
Ooh.
Yeah, so there are two bits to this. The old piece of information is the antimatter cloud. That one was discovered in the 1970s. There have been more recent observations of it, detailing its size and its shape, etc. From what I'm reading, it sounds like it's mainly positrons, which are positively charged electrons. What this new data found, this was from a four-year observation by the European Space Agency's INTEGRAL, which is an International Gamma Ray Astrophysics Laboratory satellite. And it showed that the cloud of antimatter is not symmetrical. It's skewed towards one side of the galactic center. And they found that matches a distribution of binary systems, which include,
cool,
they say, either a black hole or also possibly a neutron star. And that they think that, therefore, since the antimatter cloud matches the distribution of these binary systems, that maybe it's these binary systems that are generating all of this antimatter. So these are high-energy systems, so it makes sense that something like this could happen. But they said it was completely unexpected. It wasn't predicted by any current models. It's just an observation. So that's very interesting. The next one was, recent measurements indicate that the Pacific Plate may have temporarily stopped moving. And I believe the guys think this one's fiction. And Rebecca, you think this one is science.
I'm all alone.
And this one is fiction. This one is indeed fiction.
Phew.
Boo.
But this is based upon an actual study. This is a study which suggests there are a new hypothesis that perhaps we're talking about plate tectonics here, the movement of the Earth's plates, the different pieces of the crust are sliding past each other, and there's a Pacific Plate. And new observations suggest that perhaps sometime in the past, the plates may have stopped moving and then started up again, something like a billion years ago, nothing recently. So that was the news item. This was published in the January 4th issue of the journal Science.
All right, did anything funky happen after that work stoppage? Because that would be scary if all of a sudden the plates stopped moving. Like, damn, what's going
to
happen?
They didn't speculate as to what that might have caused. The name of the paper is Intermittent Plate Tectonics, and they said that this may have happened in the past and may happen again in the future. But we are talking about, a billion years. This means that researchers find that having a higher serum cholesterol actually has health benefits is science.
Science.
You guys are essentially correct in that this does not contradict evidence that having a high serum cholesterol, you know, specifically the bad cholesterol, or the LDL, is a risk factor for vascular disease or heart disease. This is another effect. What researchers found is that in older individuals, that having a higher dietary cholesterol or serum cholesterol was associated with an increase in muscle strength gain from exercise. So if you exercise, like do weightlifting, you'll gain more muscle if you have a higher cholesterol.
Really?
Yeah.
Only in the elderly?
The team studied 55 men and women ages 60 to 69. So the age range was 60 to 69.
Oh, okay.
What this suggests is that, you know, cholesterol is probably just a building block in the muscle that is a limiting factor. If you have a low serum cholesterol, there just isn't enough of it around to build muscle. That would be the most straightforward interpretation. It's possible that there's a more complex mechanism at work here, that it may be a cofactor, for example, in some process that's necessary for muscle building. So this does suggest a number of questions that then have to be, I mean, I think the study needs to be replicated and all these sub-questions have to be explored, but that's what they found.
Cool.
So congratulations, guys.
Thank you.
You all suck.
You guys actually had an easier time with this one than I thought. I thought I was going to throw you off with, I thought the cholesterol one would be tough, and I thought that the antimatter field would be tough.
No, two and three were tough.
Two was too implausible. I mean, more so than the usual curveballs. It just
I made it easy on all of you. I mean, I did the hard lifting.
Plate tectonic one sounded implausible, but they all did, you know, so I thought it would be okay.
Huh. Yeah, and then I came out swinging with the right answer.
There was a news item showing that this actually happened at some point in time.
Hmm.
Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yeah, and here it is. You guys have heard of Rene Descartes.
Yes.
How is he?
Cogito ergo sum.
He is.
He's actually a very, very smart and very cool guy. And if you read some of his quotes, you'll see very quickly that he was a blazingly strong skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked. I read a couple of dozen of his quotes, and I was like, wow, every single one of these is about skepticism.
Yeah, Jay, I mean, you know, he was a philosopher.
Well, he was a highly influential French philosopher, a mathematician, a scientist, and a writer.
Yeah, but Jay, his whole gig was promoting the philosophy of skepticism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I did, you know, I mean, I knew of him, but didn't read extensively anything by him.
Yeah, I just recently learned that, too.
He was also dubbed the father of modern philosophy and the father of modern mathematics. I didn't know that he had the mathematics thing in there. I knew the philosophy, but not the mathematics.
Yeah, right.
So did he say something interesting or what?
He sure did. He said, if you would be a real seeker after truth, it is necessary that at least once in your life you doubt, as far as possible, all things. Rene Descartes!
Yeah, his big contribution, you know, philosophically, was to argue that, you know, before we could begin to build a new model, a new understanding of truth, we have to tear away everything we think we know up to this point, which is largely based upon authority. So he really was trying to just sort of tear away all the authority-based knowledge that was, you know, holding people back.
That's right.
And say, let's just start from scratch, you know.
That's a good logical fallacy to get rid of.
The argument from authority. Well, thanks everyone for joining me. A pleasure
always. Thank you, Steve.
Great time. Thanks.
Good times.
Thank
good
you,
night.
Rene Descartes.
I think we had a good show this week.
Yeah.
Very. Very star-studded.
Definitely.
And keep an eye out for our next installment of SGU 5x5. It's our goal to get those out on Tuesday every week. It may be Monday, but definitely by Tuesday. That's our goal. So we'll keep those coming as well. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.